Okay, now I'm going to talk about what to do about this. I'm going to talk about it on two different levels. The first part of this will be about what you can do for yourself, and the second part is what therapy is, so you can get an idea of what the therapeutic experience is. But everybody can do this first part on their own. Now, just a note to be personal about this is that I really have changed in 7 years, not just because I've aged 7 years, but I really have changed as a person. There is somebody in this room that knew me very well before anybody else, including my husband. And there's a fellow named George in this audience, and he knew me when I was at my sickest. And he can, I'm sure he'd tell you that I act very differently now than I did then, and that I probably don't even seem like my old self. Wouldn't you say that? George can verify that there is hope. And I think you need to know that. I've been talking a lot about this disease, and it does feel overwhelming when somebody nails your fanny on it. But there is a lot of hope, and there's a lot of experience now for codependency recovery, and a lot of people that are in recovery that can demonstrate the strength of that to you. The first thing that you really need to do is consider attending some sort of 12-step meeting where you can gather around a bunch of people that are talking about the disease and talking about recovery. The meetings right now that are just very important, I would say, for any recovering codependent, the first one is ACOA or ACA, Adult Children of Alcoholics. Now, the people that are supposed to attend that meeting are people that have had alcoholic parents, but anybody from a dysfunctional family system can go to those meetings and get a lot of help, because it actually doesn't matter whether the dysfunction is caused by a drinking parent or a drug-taking parent or a sex-addicted parent or a crazy parent or an abusive, raging parent. The effects generally are absolutely the same. So ACA meetings for anybody from a dysfunctional family system are really important. I want to say something here to you also. Y'all, in that very first lecture I gave, remember that last column on the far right talked about recovery and what it looks like? Please remember, when you're going to ACA meetings, to start talking about what recovery looks like instead of massing around in the disease. It doesn't feel good to only talk about the disease at those meetings. I think it's most important as you start experiencing glimpses of recovery that you talk about that quite vigorously in those meetings. Another meeting that's real good for a codependent who has been sexually abused as a child are COSA meetings. They're for co-sex addicts. These are people that have been sexually abused as children and then have issues have difficulty being in sexual relationships with other people. They're constantly searching for love and acceptance, usually getting into acting out sexually in order to get this love and get into addicted relationships with people that aren't really very good for them or who don't treat them very well. It is an issue of codependency to be a co-sex addict. It's just a spin-off, and people that do this are people who have been sexually abused, either incested or molested. Another meeting that will fit the COSA issue that is now starting up in the Valley is that meeting for women called Women Who Love Too Much. And that book, Women Who Love Too Much, is a very good book to read. It talks about co-sex addiction. There's also another book out by Patrick Carnes called Sex Addiction. This talks about co-sex addiction in there, so either one of those books is very good for a person who is a co-sex addict. It'll talk about that. That's about getting into addicted love relationships where you're powerless and where you're being abused and offended and you stay in them anyway. Another very good meeting for a codependent is Incest Survivors Anonymous. That's new in the Valley. Actually, we got it from California. There are several in the Valley. If you want to know where they are, you can call me or call Mo, and she can get you in touch with me about how to find out where the incest survivors are. Incest survivors are for people who have suffered being incested as a child or who have been molested as a child and have issues around that. One thing about Incest Survivors Anonymous, if you were incested or molested but have become a sex offender, in terms of being an incest perpetrator or you're into molesting children, you're not welcome at that meeting. I would not attempt to go. They do not want you in there. They only want the people that have not become offenders. So that is, there's a barrier right there. I just wanted to let you know that. I have incest survivor starter packets. If you call me and you, because you want to start one somewhere in the valley, I'll be glad to send one to you. The main ones are actually over in the West End, because that's where we hold our aftercare from where I work, and that most of the people have started them over in that area. But if you want to start them out in Scottsdale and get, you know, you can get in touch with Mo or me, and we'll be glad to help you start something like that. Another meeting for a codependent, of course, is Al-Anon. Al-Anon is a good meeting that addresses adult codependency issues. It's more about your current relationship with someone, usually with an addict of some kind, but still, it does address some issues of codependency, and it's a very good meeting. And the basic one, though, that I would suggest all of you begin to attend if you are codependent are these adult children of alcoholics. The second thing that will really help you is to do a written step one, as you can follow the guideline I gave you, or if you've seen some other step, get started writing about your disease. That's the purpose of step one, to see that disease in action. And until you see it, you're not going to be able to do a thing about it. One of the things I know, by the way, about codependence is that we are very hard to treat. Very, very hard to treat. My experience with myself was that I resisted doing everything. Everything I resisted. It wasn't until I got into enough pain that I was willing to do anything. But also, as a counselor, I have met great resistance with the patients I've worked with. I mean, tremendous. And I have to repeat myself, and I have to confront and confront and confront and confront and confront. One of the hallmarks of a codependency counselor needs to be that you are very, very patient, kind, and understanding. Because you're going to have to repeat yourself a lot. Because you won't be able to hear me. I'll have to say it again and again and again and again. Eventually you'll get it, but it takes a long time. But you will resist. And that's why in the groups I run and the people I know, I have a motto for us. It's called, hug your demons or they'll bite you in the ass. You must start embracing these issues and doing something about it. If you expect anybody else to do it for you, you will stay stuck, lost, and sick. There's absolutely nobody that can do this stuff for you. No one. Who needed to have done it for you were your parents. Who needed to have treated you functionally and respectfully. Now you got to learn how to do that for you. And nobody can do that for you. Nobody's ever meant to do it for you. The third thing you can do is get yourself a codependency sponsor. I would suggest that you choose someone who, if you can, that has some recovery and is demonstrating that. But what you really need is a sponsor who can parent you, who can nurture, who's honest and confrontive, who's willing to tell you how you look, but also be able to repeat it and repeat it and repeat it and repeat it and repeat it until you get it. You need a patient, nurturing, parenting type person. I would suggest that you get a member of the same sex. Don't ever try to do this with a member of the opposite sex. You might wind up 13-stepping each other, and that's not appropriate. The fourth thing you can do on your own is to attack each symptom I talked about. The low self-esteem, the owning your reality, the needs and wants, the operating in the extremes and the boundaries. You need to begin to attack and confront within yourself each symptom. You obviously can't do that. You're not going to know what to do or what the problem is unless you get going on that written step one. So that comes first. Then do this. And do it systematically. Concentrate. Don't try to do it all at once. You'll go nuts. What I would say, if you had to pick some here, start working on the self-esteem and the boundaries. Then you can flop into owning your own reality. Then you can address the needs and wants. And the last one, which is the hardest one, is operating in the extremes. And that's where I am right now. I still flap out there in the wild blue yonder. But it's the last one I've really been able to deal with. So if you want some guidelines like that, I'll tell you that. What to do about the first one, low self-esteem? Well, obviously on the other end of this is being arrogant and grandiose. Now, if you're out being arrogant and grandiose, you have to start an understanding that what you're doing is very dysfunctional and inappropriate. If you experience the loss of the lack of esteem, the first thing you have to do is make a decision that you must not stand one down from everybody else, just like the arrogant one has to make a decision that they can't be one above everybody else. You have to start equalizing here, and you do that by making a decision that as you are enough, that you are filled. Don't shake your head, Bill, that you're filled, that you're precious and wonderful. I always know I have a codependent in my midst. It's almost diagnostic to sit and do this to someone. I say, I want you to tell me you're a wonderful, precious person. Now, a codependent in my office will go into a shame attack and be rendered speechless and then turn beet red and tell me, no, they can't do that. Make a decision that you are that way. Second thing you can do is do affirmation work, but it's a very, very specific kind of work. It's about figuring out all the shame words that you use to keep yourself feeling run down that would follow any I am statement. So you got to do an inventory of all the I am statements you give that are negative, like I am a lout, I am stupid, I am less than, I am worthless, I am inadequate, I am empty, I am awful, I am a slut, I am a jerk, you know, all that. Inventory all those nouns and adjectives that are negative in nature that would follow an I am statement, since that leads you back to the shame issue. When you figure that all out, then make another set of I am statements that disputes each negative noun and adjective. So if you're over here saying I am bad, you're over here saying I am good. If you're over here saying I am inadequate, you're over here saying I am adequate. If you're over here saying I'm worthless, you're over here saying I'm a precious person. If you're over here saying I'm stupid, you're over here saying I'm smart. Then take that list of positive statements and put them on a tape. Just list them. Take a blank tape. And you can set it out saying, like, I am Pia Melody, and the following is a list of affirmations I am using to dispute the shame core messages. And then you just sing them. I am a precious person. I am adequate. I am wonderful. And when you get all done with that, then you play it to yourself twice a day, in the morning when you get up and at night when you go to bed. And read your 24-hour book, for those of you who use one, before you read your affirmation tape. There's a real good 24-hour book for codependents. It's called Affirmations for Adult Children of Alcoholics. It's a little red book that's published by Health Communications out of Pompano Beach, Florida. It's an excellent 24-hour book for codependents. Get it. The next thing that will help your sense of esteem is to start making your boundaries work. Making boundaries work will cause you to start, you know, standing in a position where you're saying, I am worth defending. The second thing has to do with owning your own reality. That is real simple. But you have to have done your step to know where you're not owning it. If you're at B, make it up. If you're at B and don't know what your reality is and somebody challenges you and asks you what it is, you make it up. If they say, what are you feeling? And you don't know, make it up. What happens when you make it up is it will cause what it is to eventually surface, either an hour later, a minute later, a day later, a week later, or something. If when it does surface, it differs from what you said, go back to that person and tell them what it really was. There's a time gap there. That's what it's about. Because at some point, you will feel it, or think it, or know what you did or didn't do, or know what you look like. Then you go back and correct it. It'll start closing. When you do that, it'll start closing that time gap so that you'll have an awareness of who you really are as it is happening. If you're at I know and won't tell, you start telling. But be sure you're telling people that are safe. You don't want to tell unsafe people what your reality is. Don't be foolish. You don't walk up to an offender and tell them you're sexually attracted to them when you know they're going to turn around and offend you. You don't hang out your reality with people that are offenders and abusive or who are inappropriate to tell that to. You don't blab everything to everybody. Don't go out to that extreme. In terms of your needs and wants, what you have to do on your needs is make up that inventory of what your needs are, and then on a daily basis, this takes work, folks. On a daily basis, inventory, if you're at B and not knowing what the needs are, inventory your awareness that day of your own neediness and what, just simply your awareness. But if you're at A, you know what your needs are, then you inventory whether you took care of them or not. So if you work on B, you'll eventually move to A. When you're at A, you start taking care of your needs and confronting yourself. So if you're aware that you've got a decent, that you've got a cavity, you got a need there to take care of, then instead of waiting till you have to have a root canal, you know, waiting 4 months, till you have to call the doctor up at Sunday night because you got an abscess going, that you do it immediately. You make an appointment with the dentist immediately to get that tooth fixed. Now, you force yourself to do it. In terms of the wanting, If you are completely wantless in your being, don't know what you want, you have to start making up what you think you might want when somebody asks you or when you need to do that. If you are wanting but not getting it, if you can afford it, you start forcing yourself to get it. If you can afford it, don't. Not to go out to the extreme and get every single thing that ever occurs to you so you bankrupt yourself. Don't fling yourself way out to that extreme. You stay within moderate reason. If you're wanting everything and not noticing your needs, you need to pull back and moderately approach what you want and discipline yourself, and then start putting your needs first until you get that balance straightened out. In terms of operating in the extremes, if my husband would come up and talk about that, you'd probably get more out of it, because this is one area I'm still blurred. But he's not there, so I'll do it myself. What that is about is flinging yourself out into one extreme or the other as you are living. And I talked about this a little bit before, but I'll do it again. Understand that moderation is your goal. And when you've done your step one and you have some idea of how you operate here, operate there, start catching yourself when you're doing or wanting to do it. And what you do is, if you find yourself over here, visualize the very opposite. You're going to want to move over here to correct it, but don't. Instead, visualize yourself walking towards the center and making a decision to do something moderate, understanding at all times and for a very long time, actually, you'll feel as though you haven't responded enough. Know that's normal. Continue doing that. Eventually, you'll start feeling very uncomfortable about flinging yourself out here. Then you know you're starting to move into recovery. In terms of boundaries, I've already explained that to you. That's about making your external boundary and your internal boundary working by those exercises. I showed you one for the external with Amy, and I demonstrated the internal with that little let it in, keep it out, and throw it out imagery work. But of course, before you can do that, you have to evaluate the condition of each part of your boundary system. So you have to do that written step first. So if you've written out the step and you know the condition, then you need to start addressing each issue. Let me show you something, too. I don't think I said this before in terms of your boundaries, but it is very common for people to bounce between walls and nothing. And some people think that they bounce between a damaged one and nothing. So they bounce here and here. So if some of you, when you assess, find yourself wanting to do that, go ahead and do that. Write down whatever you think it is. If I haven't explained something but you think it's different than what I said, then write that down. It really doesn't matter. Own your own reality about it. But anyway, you have to start correcting these conditions. And you do it by memorizing those statements I gave you and start, as you get into negotiating distance and touch or negotiating that emotional intellectual boundary, that you use it. You force yourself to use it. Believe me, when you start that up, when you crank up to do that, you will have great difficulty. Understand that that is the case. But if you keep working at it, one day you'll make it work and it'll be like moving from night to day. But you're going to have to approach it probably many times before it works for you. You keep doing it anyway. Because I travel around the country and do a lot of work out there, I get a lot of phone calls. Ask my secretary. And I have people, hey, I'm trying to do it. I say, okay, I know, I hear you, but do it anyway. I can't. Yes, it's not that you can, it's that you won't. You do it. You call me tomorrow after you've done that. I don't want to hear that you didn't do it. You go ahead and do it anyway. Have to. And remember, the external boundary is about distance and touching, and the internal boundary is about letting things in, keeping things out, and throwing things out. And you are absolutely the only people that can do that kind of thing for yourself. Nobody can do it, not even me. I can tell you how to do it. I can support you in doing it, but I can't make you do it. You're the only one that can do that. Now, let's talk about therapy. The therapy for this, I call post-induction therapy. you know why I call it post induction therapy? I don't know, I made it up. Somebody sat in there talking about what to call this. It's really, I call it post induction therapy because it is, post induction refers to the carried feeling reality. It's really about induced feeling reality, not carried, but carried makes it easier to understand. And post means after you now sit in life with a lot of carried feeling on board, what to do. 5-part process, you've already experienced the first part. Believe me, sitting in here all day, if this is the first time you've heard it, is a miserable experience. So if you're feeling miserable and overwhelmed, understand that that is part of the why I am doing it. What I want to do is create that effect. I want to get your attention. I want to get your attention. Education. You need to understand what the disease is, what it looks like, what the symptoms are, and what to do about it. You need to have it made personal for you. I don't believe therapy is effective when you don't know what you're doing. If you've ever been to a therapist and you mash around on a whole lot of stuff, and I wonder what you're doing in there day after day, you know you're feeling a little bit better, but you don't quite know what's really going on. I don't believe in that kind of therapy. I believe in getting in, taking care of the business, and getting out, and getting about your work of living, not going to the therapist. Get in, get your business done, and get out, and get up on with the business of living. I have a lot of friends who have become addicted to therapy. You know, every little bump on their nose, they have to go in, and they can't do anything without asking their therapist. That's ridiculous. And in order to really understand how to get in and get out, you need the education to know what the problem is. And actually, it's rather simple.
This is the end of Side 1. For more valuable information, turn cassette over now and continue to listen on Side 2. Do not fast forward.
Debriefing. Second thing is about what we call dialoguing and debriefing. Dialoguing is the work of the therapist. Debriefing is the work of the codependent. Debriefing, again, is your work. You can't do that until you get your history straight. You can't get your history straight until you write about it. But when you debrief, because you've gotten your history written down, you do it this way, just as you wrote it down. You tell someone, your group, your counselor, your sponsor, this is what happened to me that was abusive. And about that, I feel, and you list your feeling reality. That's called debriefing. In other words, you're sharing your history and having your feelings about it without judgment. You don't go in, Dad did a terrible, awful thing. He was a lout and a creep and a crumb. This is what he did. And you list it specifically without judgmental terms involved. And about that, I feel this way. Dialoguing is the work of the therapist. It's a corrective process. It's that process I told you that needs a lot of patience. I feel like saying to describe this, yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. Anybody in my aftercare kind of knows they've seen me do this very gently. It's about correcting. You know, when you say things and you're taking responsibility, for example, for your father incesting you, you know, you're blaming yourself for him doing that, or you're minimizing, denying, you're in an active state of delusion. Somebody in here asked me earlier today, because I know her family history, she said she wasn't abused. I said, but I know your family, you were abused. No, I wasn't abused. I said, you know, you're in an active state of delusion. I was dialoguing with her the minute I said that to her. Okay? That is the work of the therapist. It's a corrective process so that you can tell your history in an unskewed fashion. It is highly directive. It is interrupting. Somebody says to me, I'm having them debrief, and they say, well, you know, my father abused me, but it wasn't that bad for you. What he did, I say, stop. You know, I won't permit you to say that to me. You say, my father abused me by doing this to me. Now I make them do it. They go back and have to say it my way. They don't do it. They're not going to get where they need to go. The third part of the work is called shame reduction work. Now, the fourth part is called integration work. The reason why I listed them like that and both at the same time is because sometimes integration has to be done here before shame reduction work, but sometimes shame reduction work has to be done before integration can be done. It's the job of your therapist to know which one to do first, but I'll explain each process to you. Shame reduction work is the symbolic work of giving back to the people who offended you the reality of the shame core. It happens like this. It happens in group. I wouldn't suggest ever doing this. I really would not try to do this with someone on a one-to-one basis. I think group therapy is the treatment process of choice for codependents because they need so much validation of their reality. But anyway, what you do is you sit in group with your counselor next to you and you put a chair across the room from you and you image into the room a person who offended you as a child and you literally debrief with them. Instead of talking to the group as a whole about what this person did, you talk directly to that person. It's all imagery work. It's all role play work. And that goes in two parts. A is a statement, this is what you did to me. And about that, I feel, and you list out your feeling reality. And you just keep going down through your history. You've obviously had to go through the experience of writing your history and the practice debriefing before you can ever do this. When you get done with all your history and how you feel about it, you move into part B. And about that, I'm angry. I have a right to be angry. And I give you back your shame. It's all symbolic work. Makes you feel good, though. It's a good way of straightening out all the baloney. Now, I've got something to tell you about that complicates that whole process. And it has to do with the carried feeling reality. You see, it's actually unusual to work with a codependent where the only thing in that shame core is shame. Most people have some other kind of feeling reality that's within that shame core, and it'll surface at a level, at the level of and about that I feel. You will find that the feeling reality will come up on two levels, depending upon who you're talking to and whether what feeling reality, the other feeling reality, they also, that you carry for them. So, in the four feelings, again, that will surface are anger, fear, pain, and shame. I'm going to put a line above shame and tell you that I'm not speaking about shame at this moment. I'm speaking about anger, fear, and pain. The moment you say, and I feel, and follow it with anger, fear, or pain, it may surface as your own feeling reality or the carried feeling reality. It will surface as the carried or induced feeling reality if there's feeling reality in that same core that particular person dumped on you. How to tell whether it's your own or the carried is this. Remember that diagram I gave you that shows you that when you're in the carried feeling reality and it's anger, you will be raging. When it's pain, you'll be feeling hopeless. When it's fear, you're going to be feeling panic. Well, when you're saying about that I feel fear, if you move on into panic, you're obviously in the carried fear that you must have for that person. You must be packing fear on board. It could be fear of this person's sexuality. It could be fear of their femininity. It could be fear of old age. It could be fear of poverty. It could be fear of riches. It could be anything that you might, that might surface in terms of what the fear is about, or what the pain's about, or what the anger's about. Maybe that you're confronting Dad, and he was angry with Mom and never dealt with it, but talked to you about how he hated and raged at her in front of you. So you carry a lot of that anger for him, and it surfaces, and you start raging when you confront him. Then what's going to happen is you obviously are carrying his anger for your mom that he never dealt with and was irresponsible with in front of you. When it comes up as your own, and again, your own feeling reality is not overwhelming. It might be intense, but it's not overwhelming. You're not going to be raging. You're not going to be panicking. You won't be doubled up and feeling hopeless. It'll be your own, then move on. But if it comes up as carried, you have to move into a very special sentence. It's this: I give you back your part of this, and then you list the feeling. In other words, I keep my own, but I give yours back because I can't take care of your feeling reality. I'm on overwhelm when I try. And you repeat that and repeat that and repeat that and repeat that, and there will be a shift. You can feel it. You will go down, you will move from total panic, for example, down into just being afraid, because you may be afraid of this person. Let me give you an example. That's the best example I have. I was working with a woman whose mother beat her within an inch of her life daily until she was 4, starting as an infant, until the family finally said, "Stop this, you can't." Mom beat her fearlessly. This woman carried a lot of her mom's fear. When I had to bring her mom into the room, I actually had two people stand next to the chair because she was worried Mom was going to leap out of the chair and get her. So two people were standing on each side of the chair, and I was sitting next to her holding on, because as a therapist, I knew that she was going to go into panic. But I didn't know if she'd go into this kind of panic. Anyway, so she brought her mom into the room. I had John and Pat standing on each side of the chair, and I'm sitting here, and she went silent. And I was looking and listening and waiting, and we're all looking at her. Turned around, I said, "Okay, what's going on with you?" And she did this. She said, you know, and I'm going, "Uh-oh." I said, "You know, you're in a panic state right now." And I said, "Are your legs paralyzed? They feel mushy." Said that. I said, "Right now, I mean, this woman didn't go into this is what you did and then go into her carried feeling reality. She went immediately into panic, and that's not unusual with fear." I said, "Okay, what did you say to your mother?" "I carry your fear. I'm afraid of you. I have a lot of fear of my own, but I also carry your fear. You were fearless in your abuse of me, and I give you back your part of this fear. I keep my own because I need to be afraid of you, but I give you back yours." Now, it took her, I think, 10 minutes to say that once. It took 30 minutes for her to say it about 4 times. And then she went silent again. Meanwhile, I'm kind of, you know, off into la-la land myself. It's very difficult, concentrated work. And Pat and John, who were standing on each side of the chair, were really spaced out. They were just like that, you know, but hanging onto the chair. Anyway, she got real silent. I just started to turn to her. I was kind of watching them and her at the same time with my peripheral vision when she screamed out, "I give you back your effing fear." Screamed it as loud as she could. Both John and Pat leaped back away from the chair as though they were stuck with a cattle prod. I turned and looked at her, and she's smiling. I said, "Well, how are you doing?" "I'm fine. Mom's got her effing fear." I go, "Oh, really?" "Yeah." She said, "Tell John and Pat to get back away from the chair. I'm going after Mom." I said, "What does Mom look like?" "She's scared to death, and I'm ready to go do my work." Now, we didn't even get into this before we had to deal with the carried fear. It could have been carried pain. It could have been carried anger, but it'll surface like that. Now, do you get the drift of what I mean? Now, let's move down to shame. Shame you don't give back at A level. Remember those shame words I told you to identify on worthless, stupid, inadequate, bad? Those are shame words. At A level, when you bring up the fact that, and about that, I feel your shame. When shame comes up when you're doing this work, it is always carried or induced shame. It isn't your own. It never will be. So what you have to say somewhere after each one of your episodes you're talking about, you must say, "And about that, you shame me, I carry your shame, it makes me feel like I am stupid, worthless, inadequate, less than, da-da-da-da-da," what the litany is. This helps you begin to understand and start to mentally shift this back to who it belongs to. So carried feelings, anger, fear, and pain, you move at this level. Seeing, you just discuss. If it's your own, move through them. When you get down here, then, this will work. If you don't take care of the carried feeling up here, it'll surface down here. Like you'll go into a panic attack when you try to say, I give you back your shame. You'll go into crying, you'll go into a panic attack, you'll start raging. It'll surface again in front of that carried stuff, so you have to move back up at the AA anyway. And moving back and forth on what you do is really your therapist's business anyway. You're there for the ride. That's one time you are solely there for the ride and the show. They're supposed to tell you how to do it. If you get with someone that flops around with that, get yourself someone else. The next part of the work is called integration of the precious child. That is symbolic work too. I'll show you something about codependency. Took a long time to understand. What you find here is that you as a codependent, or me as a codependent, before I got into recovery, had two parts of me that were at war. I had an adult part of me that kind of resided on the right side of me, and I had a child part of me that kind of hung out on the left side of me. What had happened to me is that I was severely abused in my family of origin, and how I acted that out is that this adult knew, as this adult parented me, it parented me abusively. In other words, as the child part of me was in action, my adult part of me abused my child part of me. But as I parented myself, as I took care of myself, I did it abusively, and I was constantly abusing my child. What happens is, this is another way to look at codependency, and this is really the icing on the cake. This is kind of hard to understand, but once you get this, you'll really understand the disease. What happens to you then as an adult, which keeps the disease going, is that as you do not take care of your child part of you and you abuse that child is the one that goes into the shame attack. That's why, you know, I told you, part of the shame attack is starting to feel, look at that, and not defend yourself. That's why, what happens is that you abuse that child, they go into a shame attack, and then guess who's in charge of your life? A 3-year-old child or a 10-year-old child. You can't do very well when you're living like that most of the time. Integration work is about stopping this whole process. And what you do is you do it in group again, but instead of bringing the offender into the room or somebody that abused you as a child, you bring yourself into the room the way you look sometimes at some point between age 6 and 10. The reason why I say somewhere between 6 and 10 because it won't work very well if you bring a child into the room that's still engaged in magical thinking. You need to bring a child that can start thinking logically into the room and who therefore is aware that they're being abused. And you bring them into the room and you set them down in a chair and you talk to them. Your counselor, your therapist will have you start dialoguing with that child. I have them bring them into the room and I say, okay, now, where is that child and what do they look like? Well, they'll say things like this. Well, they're standing in the corner, they have the back to me and they won't turn around. Or she's sitting in the chair and she's sitting very quietly. She's perfect. She's sitting there smiling like this, but I can tell she's afraid. You know, they'll describe whatever it is. Who knows what it is? I say, well, what's the look on their face? Well, gosh, she's got big black circles under her eyes. Her hair's hanging in her face and she's weeping. Whatever it is, I have them describe. And then basically what I have them do is tell the child that they were abused and that they're going to now make a commitment to the child to stop abusing them themselves and that they will now take responsibility for nurturing and appropriately parenting that child and that it is safe to do it. If the child agrees to do that, then I have the child move up into the patient's lap. And I have the patient start rocking and nurturing that child. This is very, very, very painful work. I have a hard time not weeping. Tears usually run down my face. I just can't stop it. Now, then I have the person take that child and compress it down into like the size of a green apple in their hand like that. And then I have them mash it into their chest. On the left side, tell them to wrap that child around their heart and to hold them in there. That's called integration work, and it's a commitment to stop abusing and start taking care of. This will significantly reduce people's shame attacks because it makes them much more aware of not taking care of themselves. Sometimes you have to integrate before shame reduction work. If you have a person really that has been very, very seriously abused, they may not have the wherewithal and the energy to do shame reduction work, but if you make them bring their child into the room and stand next to them or sit in their lap while they talk to their parents, believe me, there's a volcano that starts to go off in that chair, and they will defend the child when they can visualize the child here. And sometimes they need to do that before they can even begin this. It's a therapeutic decision as to which you do first. And that's a therapist's responsibility, not yours. You're again along for the ride. The last part of the process is absolutely wonderful. When you get here, you get near the bloody end of the thing. It's called forgiveness. Now, there's two people to forgive, yourself and the people that offended you. Self-forgiveness sometimes can be a horrible battle because it isn't unusual for us as codependents to have been offensive and abusive to our own children, as well as now highly aware of how we didn't take care of ourselves. But self-forgiveness has to start right there. The other part is about forgiving the people who abused you. There's a decision to be made there. If your parents didn't maliciously abuse you and really are supporting your recovery, at least trying to understand it and not interfering with it, then you can move on into just a fairly open forgiveness process. But if your parents were malicious, if they truly intended to hurt you, if they are continuing to act shamelessly, if they're trying to attack your recovery and prevent it, then you do not do that. Instead, or if they're dead, but everything was just absolutely horrible, instead what you do is you move into a grieving process. What you do is you have to go through that, through a grieving process about how it really was and how that hurt, and also you automatically will go into grieving the fantasy of what you thought you had. Now that is Pain City. Bad enough facing the dynamics of what it really was, but when you go into grieving the fantasy you made up for 40 years, believe me, that is Pain City. It took me 2 years to move through my grieving process, but when I got done, guess what had happened? I had forgiven them. And I had enough self-esteem and boundary systems on board set up finally that I can be around my parents now. My father, I'm not around my mother. I can be around my father now and function very well, and I don't get into what I call the pig pen with the pigs. I walk around the pig pen. I don't get into it with my father and my siblings. I walk right around. I just observe them, and I'm fine, and I have to get into it with them. And I've forgiven them, and I can be there with them, but I'm not in the pig pen. And that's the therapy involved. So there is something you can do, and there's something that you can ask a therapist to do for you. And people that have been trained in this know how to do that for you, so there's a lot of hope. And that's the end of this lecture.